I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The current political climate can make the partisan gap in state legislatures difficult to overcome, but Missouri lawmakers, in some respects, have recently bucked the trend. Today, we'll talk to the Missouri State Auditor about legislation that she pushed for that attracted bipartisan support. One bill protects government whistleblowers from punishment. Then, mental health professionals join us to discuss teen suicide prevention. It's a topic that many are thinking about now during Mental Health Month and after the controversial release of the second season of 13 Reasons Why. That's a Netflix show that some say glamorizes teen suicide. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The question of the day for Missouri state government: should Governor Eric Greitens be allowed to spend taxpayer dollars on private attorneys to represent him as he faces possible impeachment by the Missouri House of Representatives? State Auditor Nicole Galloway is asking questions about this arrangement, and she's also talking about the recently completed legislative session. One of her priorities: restoring whistleblower protections for state workers, and that was achieved. Auditor Nicole Galloway joins me here in the studio, and welcome back, Nicole. Always good to have you here.
Thank you.
Well, you work in Jefferson City. What's the atmosphere like right now as the legislature prepares to consider the impeachment of a governor?
Certainly, there's a lot of uncertainty. And just as we heard, there's new developments that are coming forth
every day,
yeah. Every week. As you mentioned, what I am focused on, as I always am focused on, is protecting taxpayers and getting answers for taxpayers. And I have real concerns about taxpayers paying for the governor's private attorneys for the disciplinary actions that are before the House right now.
Now, he claims that that's perfectly within his prerogative to have taxpayers pay for those attorneys. What are some of the questions you have about this?
Well, we have criticized in previous audits how private attorneys are hired by the state. So this is not a new issue for my office. We want to know, what's the budget and where is this being paid for from the state budget? The governor has a small budget. The governor's office has a small budget. And we have criticized even Jane Nixon in funneling money from departments and agencies up into the governor's office budget to pay for things. And so as these legal bills start to rack up, I mean, they're going to get pretty expensive. If they're funneled from departments, what services are citizens forgoing to pay for these legal expenses?
So you've asked for these documents. You've asked for these costs associated with hiring these attorneys, Nicole. Have you gotten answers from the governor's office?
We've gotten some, but not all. We are seeking more information. There are multiple layers to this. The attorney general contacted my office and sent a letter and said that he shares concerns with taxpayer funds going towards private attorneys. We've also talked to the state auditor's office the state treasurer's office, because the treasurer is responsible for issuing payments.
He writes the checks.
That's right. Essentially, their response was that they issue the payments that are directed by the governor's administration with very little review. And so we have more follow-up questions. We're going to get to the answer or get to the bottom of this for taxpayers. Taxpayers deserve to know how their money's being spent. And when they're paying their taxes, I don't think this is what they had in mind.
Where are we going here? I mean, could there be a lawsuit filed to stop these payments from going from the state of Missouri to the governor's attorneys, Nicole, or what might happen here?
We need more information before we make that final determination. I mean, we need a lot more information here. In the past, and some previous audits I have done of the governor and his administration, they were not forthcoming with information that we requested, and we had to issue a subpoena to get information. I will use all legal mechanisms available to me to get to the bottom of this. We need to get all the information before we determine what all the next steps are.
And potentially, could it lead to a lawsuit? Is that a potential outcome down the road?
Certainly there's a lot of potential avenues of where this can go, but we don't have all the answers, and so that's very premature to say that.
Okay. Could the state legislature step in and say this money should not be appropriated for private attorneys?
I don't know if the state legislature has appropriated this money for private attorneys. That's an issue that they had with the previous administration on the appropriation within the governor's office. So again, we want answers to the very questions that you are asking.
How long of a process do you think we're in for here as the House begins its work on impeachment? Is this thing going to be wrapped up in June? Are we going to have an answer to this, or is this going to stretch out throughout much of the rest of the year?
You know, I think that this, you know, we're in the very beginning stages from what I can understand, and I think it's going to take some time. The legislature has set themselves a timeline here. What's unfortunate is that for taxpayers, this process could cost tens of thousands of dollars, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars. And there's been bipartisan calls for the governor to resign and step down. Unfortunately, he's putting the state through this. Our reputation as a state is tied directly to the reputation of our chief executive, the governor. And so how we're perceived nationally and internationally matters to Missouri. And this is what everybody's focused on. That's what's in the news right now here in Missouri. And that's when external entities are looking at Missouri right now. This is what they're seeing. And that's not good for us.
So you think we're paying a price right now for all this tumult in the state capitol?
I agree with that, yes.
Yeah. You know, lots of people, as you just pointed out, have called for the governor to resign. Some say he should be impeached, others don't. Have you taken a public position on this?
He should summon the integrity to resign. Again, this is hurting our state. Now we are all going to have to live through this process, however long it might take.
State Auditor Nicole Galloway is my guest. Let's turn to what happened during the legislative session, Nicole, because one of your priorities I wanted to talk to you about was to see that whistleblower protections were restored for state employees. First, tell us what happened last year that resulted in these whistleblower protections actually being removed here.
So there's a bill called Senate Bill 43, and there was a lot in that bill. One of the lesser known items in that bill was the removal of whistleblower protections for state and local government employees. And these are folks that know the most about improper activity in the workplace.
Well, why would someone push forward a proposal to strip those protections from state workers? What was the motivation?
It makes no sense. It's not as if there is just a proliferation of whistleblower lawsuits within our state. Whistleblowers know when illegal activity is happening, improper use of taxpayer dollars. It costs us money as taxpayers. They should be able to come forward without fear of retaliation or being fired to call out bad behavior in the workplace. And as auditor, you know, working with whistleblowers is auditor 101,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
We want people to come forward and share
information.
It's
journalism 101 too,
yes,
yeah, for that
absolutely.
Matter.
Absolutely.
And the fear here is that if a whistleblower came forward in the wake of this bill being passed, he or she could be fired? Is that what we're talking about here?
That's right, or with some form of retaliation, including being fired. For instance, the Department of Corrections workplace issues got a lot of attention within Kansas City because of news reports of improper activity and workplace culture. Whistleblowers coming forward shined a light on those issues. After the bill was passed last year, they could then be retaliated against for shining a light on those issues, which need to be fixed, which desperately need to be fixed. I'm so pleased that the legislature took this seriously and in a bipartisan way fixed this issue.
I was going to say, so the new law passed and these protections now are back in place. Do I have that right?
That's right. They make us a leader for protecting whistleblowers and government, whether it be a state employee or a local government employee. It also, something that was in that bill, is it removes the ability to use non-disclosure agreements for taxpayer-funded legal settlements, NDAs.
And what does that mean then?
What that means, I mean, NDAs got a lot of attention.
Non-disclosure agreements.
That's correct.
Yeah.
But for instance, in D.C., when there's taxpayer-funded settlements and there's basically a veil of secrecy that falls over those settlements where people can't talk about them, all that does is create more secrecy and more shadows over bad government practices and bad behavior in government. We need to shine a light on that so we can fix it. Taxpayers deserve that type of transparency.
So now we can find out what these settlements were, what they were for, how much was paid out, and that'll be public information.
That's right. And we did an audit of the legal expense fund and found about $115 million taxpayer dollars paid for legal expenses settlements from the state.
Some of them involving sexual harassment, right?
Yes, that's right. And so this is another example of my audits getting results, concrete results, where we have been able to change the laws because of audits that we have done.
You know, you also talked about another victory, which involved creating what you called an equal playing field for taxpayers. What's that about?
Sure. So we did a very big audit about income tax refunds. There were thousands and thousands of taxpayer refunds that were late. And in that audit, we found there's an uneven playing field between the government and the taxpayer. If you're the government and you're late paying a refund, it's like less than 1% interest. It's almost nothing. If you're a taxpayer and you're late paying your taxes to the state, ooh, you're charged 4% interest plus penalties and on and on. It's not equal at all. And so the legislature, again, agreed with us in a bipartisan way. And because of that audit, we were able to pass a law to even the playing field between the government and the taxpayer.
Again, State Auditor Nicole Galloway is my guest. You've praised lawmakers for passing legislation that protects the personal information of children. This came after your office completed 5 school district audits focused on cybersecurity. Explain that one to us.
Cybersecurity has been a huge focus of my office. And when I traveled the state talking about cybersecurity, I was shocked that schools are not required to notify parents or guardians, faculty and staff if there's a data breach. As a parent, how can you fix or monitor your kid's credit score if you have no idea their personal information has been stolen or compromised? And so we were able to pass a law that requires school to notify parents if there's a data breach that involves their students' personal information. As a parent, I would want to know.
Yeah. You know, you're involved in a reelection campaign this year. How do you manage to get voters interested in a down-ballot race like the state auditor's race?
You know, for me, I believe that taxpayers want an independent watchdog. I audit Democrats and Republicans alike. I audit everybody. I am tough and I am thorough. In a time when there's so many scandals, public corruption issues, people want someone that's independent that will stand on their side. They work really hard for their money. They work really hard, and they want value and a protection out of the state auditor's office for the taxpayer dollars that they send to government. And, you know, I just truly believe that in the auditor's office, you need to be willing to criticize members of your own party, even if it happens to be the governor. Otherwise, you should not be seeking this job. I have done that my entire career in this office.
How many states have elected state auditors?
It's about 50-50. About half are elected.
Because there's been talk that Kansas needs an elected state auditor, and there's been reluctance to move that way. But a lot of folks think that would be a good idea. And I gather you would endorse that idea given who you are here.
People are hungry for accountability. They are hungry for transparency. They want light to be shined on government. They are demanding accountability and are standing up for it in ways that they maybe haven't done before, given what's going on in our state capital.
How do you guys decide which areas of state government you're going to train your focus on and what you're going to perform audits on? I'm guessing, like in a newsroom, you get lots of propositions, lots of proposals for things you could go and look at. How do you sort through those and decide what you're going to actually train your sights on?
Right. We have to be responsible with our limited taxpayer resources, right? I manage taxpayer resources when I go out and conduct audits. And so it's a balance of things. Some of it are priorities of myself, the auditor. Otherwise, it might be whistleblowers contacting our office saying, you know, we have a real concern. We have seen this and we determine something's credible and then move forward with that. And so it's a balance of things. We want to get results for taxpayers. We want to shine a light on issues. And we have shown over and over again our ability to do that.
How many auditors do you have in the office? How many people do you oversee?
About 115.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And most are CPAs, are certified fraud examiners like myself, or have some other type of special designation. I am so proud of my staff. They are true public servants that really believe that they're making a difference for the taxpayers and Missourians in the state. And I could not agree more.
That's State Auditor Nicole Galloway. Nicole, always good to have you here. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to switch topics and move to teen suicide prevention, an important thing to talk about as well. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, we spoke with two young women who refused to stay silent about sexual misconduct that they experienced in the Kansas and Missouri state capitals. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, Pulitzer Prize winner and New York Times bestselling author John Meacham will be here. He'll join us for a chat about his new book, The Soul of America. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, something is going on with our kids, and it's not good. The suicide rate for white children and teens between 10 and 17 was up 70% between 2006 and 2016. Black children and teens kill themselves less often than white kids. Still, the rate of increase was higher, 77%. In the Kansas City area, suicide is the second leading cause of death for young people between the ages of 10 and 24. So what do we do about it? What's the answer? We'll try to find out now. With us today, Kelsey Prather is the Youth Suicide Prevention Specialist for Tri-County Mental Health Services that serves Clay, Platte, and Ray counties. Kelsey, nice to have you. Welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
Kathy Blanch is a crisis clinician for suicidal youth, also at Tri-County Mental Health Services. Kathy, welcome to you.
Hi.
So what's going on out there, Kelsey? I mean, what's your best theory as to what's happening to our kids?
Well, to answer that...
In 20 seconds. Yeah, there you go.
A lot of pressure. There's a lot of different things going on now than there were, say, 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Social media being one.
We have, yes, a very high presence of social media with our kids, being bombarded by lots of different things, comparison, violence. I have kids as young as fourth grade talking about how stressful politics is.
Wow.
Things like that.
Not to mention bullying.
Yes, yeah. Bullying especially. So there's a lot of pressure and comparison from that. School shootings, not to mention. I mean, there's a lot of things going on that is really overstimulating our young developing brains.
You know, Kathy, if I understand right, there's been not as much research as you might think on the impact of social media, the use of cell phones on our kids. And as a dad myself, that has concerned me for a bunch of years because we've done talk shows on it and we don't know what these things are doing to our kids.
Yeah, you have a right to be concerned because it is very impactful. I have read some research on it and it is a great negative impact. I think parents have a lot more clout in that area than what they are realizing or taking advantage of, that these kids, because of their brains just in a developmental stage, they need to not have the electronic stimulation and the constant stimulation that phones present to them. We're all addicted to them, adults and kids alike, but being able to regulate that, take the phones away from them at 9 p.m. and say, they're going to be in my room, I will charge them for you, you'll get them back at 7 a.m., before school or whatever your household rules are. But the kids need to have the downtime, and they're not having them. It's 24 hours a day stimulation by those things.
And you think about it, Kelsey, the biggest variable in our society, or at least I think it is in the last 20 years, is cell phones and social media and all the stuff that comes with it.
There is a direct correlation with the amount of social media usage, phones, Netflix binging, that's another thing, TV, video games, direct correlation of that usage with the rise of anxiety, depression, and suicide in our society. I mean, the correlation is there. It's there.
And you think about it, that's just scary to me.
Right.
I mean, correlation and everything else, that's a real concern.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, what's the biggest reason that you've come across, Kathy, for why young people commit suicide these days? Do you have a sense of it?
Well, it's different for so many of the kids, but the anxiety and depression are really skyrocketing. And I think the social media, the cell phone usage is a big factor in that. Pressure on youth today is a factor. The anxiety and depression, I work with these kiddos every day in the schools, in the community, and anxiety and depression are hand in hand with just about everyone that I come across. So that's a huge factor.
So as far as you're concerned, it's an epidemic when you talk about anxiety, when you talk about depression.
I would say so, yeah.
And what complicates all this, Kelsey, is just this idea that as the parent of two young men myself, you know, a lot of young people don't want to talk about what's going on in their lives. They don't want to express themselves to their parents. It may be true that males tend to fall into that camp a little more often than females. I don't want to overgeneralize here. But so what do you do with that?
So actually, the number one protective factor for youth is having a trusted adult in their life. I know for me in high school, my parents weren't necessarily the first people to talk to, so I can see where you come from on that. What we encourage kids to do is to come up with at least three trusted adults who they could go to if themselves or a friend had a problem. So is that a coach? Is that a teacher? Is it a school counselor? Who are your school counselors, by the way? You know, getting those questions out, having just a general conversation, and that's another thing that we're really trying to do is trying to encourage parents to ask about their mental health and not necessarily bombard them with those questions, but it's okay to check in even if you don't see warning signs.
How direct can a parent be, would you recommend, when it comes to mental health? What do you say along those lines?
Very direct. I would say if you are very concerned about your child, I had a parent ask me, you know, my child has been in his room for the past couple of months, just going to his room, turning the lights off, sitting on his phone all night, won't speak to anyone. This has been going on for a while. What should I do? I don't want to ask him if he's suicidal or anything. And I said, well, actually, that's okay to ask. In fact, that's encouraged to ask if you're worried about that, because that question has actually proven to alleviate stress. It does not encourage them to follow through with suicide or plant the idea in their head. That's one of the biggest myths that we battle with, actually. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, in the more severe situations, it's very important to be direct about things like suicide. With mental health in general, to just check in with it and say, hey, are you feeling anxious lately? Or do you feel pressured? And how can I support you in that? Or just kind of tell me about that.
I think is that a harder ask for parents of my generation? I mean, I don't think we're nearly as open in a lot of ways as kids are today about so many things. That's been a revelation to me with my own kids. And I'm wondering, I think a lot of parents might struggle with that.
Mm-hmm. So we actually have tips on how to have those conversations at encouragehopeandhelp.com.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, asking them if they ask those questions, if the parents ask those questions and the kids aren't wanting to open up, even if the kid says, Mom, I don't want to talk about that. The fact of the matter is you open that door for future reference. So if, say, the daughter then does feel like, well, maybe I can talk to my mom about that. You know, she has been asking me a few times. Maybe I can go to her, not now, but at a later time. The fact that you're opening that door means everything, and you're reducing the stigma. You're making the child feel more comfortable talking about it. So even if they don't want to talk to you about it then, they might later on. And then inquire who is someone that you could talk to. If it's not me, that's totally okay if it's not me, but I want to support you in any way that I can.
Kathy, what's your sense of the extent to which parents struggle with how to deal with their kids these days on these tough issues?
Yeah, it's high and it's hard. I think one of the things like Kelsey was saying is that you need to open the door to those conversations. But even opening those doors needs to come with a relationship. You need to build a relationship with your kids, spending the time with them and connecting with them. I mean, we're talking eye-to-eye contact here. You know, you can have a family sitting in a room and every one of them will be on their cell phones, but we're together, but they're not together. They don't have the eye contact and the connection. And so spending, you know, family meals together, having outings, laughing together, building that relationship and that so that they do feel that they can open up to you more. Like Kelsey said, if they're not feeling they can open up to you, finding those trusted adults where they can, but they know that you're on their side, supporting them, having an outlet for those communications. The communications need to happen. There's really two main factors that keep children protected, and that's building the resilience in them. And that one is connection, mm-hmm. and that's what they're lacking. The other one is empowerment. They need to feel that they can impact their future of their life. If they feel that there's no hope, anything they do, you know, is not going to make a difference, that's a huge risk factor for suicide.
I want to get to that idea of empowering for the future. But before I do that, I want to make sure I put out a phone number here for National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Kelsey, do you want to put it out here? Or I got it here. 1-800-273-TALK. 1-800-273-8255. And there's also a crisis text line. Kathy, tell us about that.
Yeah, it's a text line. You know, the kids today are texting most, you know, more often than even making a phone call. And so there's a text line. If you text a hello to 741-741, they will connect you with a mental health professional so that you can have a conversation via text.
And which might be a more comfortable place for some kids to
exactly.
be. Exactly. Getting into that whole idea of a lack of face-to-face contact sometimes. Yeah, yeah.
And something to understand is you don't have to be suicidal to call this number or to text, that they are there to talk with you about things that are upsetting you. You know, they will ask the important questions and make sure that you're getting the help you need. But if someone says, I'm not actively suicidal, these numbers and resources are still there for them.
I want to put those numbers out again real quickly. 1-800-273-TALK. And also you can text to 741-741.
Correct.
Okay. If our listeners want to join our conversation, parents or kids who have struggled with some of these issues, we'd like to have a conversation with you. Our number, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Kathy, this notion of you want to empower young people to think about their futures in a proactive way, explain that a little more to us and what you were talking about there.
Well, it's instilling the idea into youth that they impact their lives, that they are able to be effective in directing their future. Part of, you know, having a trusted adult is someone who believes in you, loves you unconditionally, and has faith in you. And if a youth feels like an adult has faith in them that they can actually accomplish, that empowers them. And that's mm-hmm. huge. That's really huge.
Yeah. You know, I'm wondering, too, Kelsey, about how a parent can tell about whether a son or daughter is depressed or is suicidal, if they can make a distinction between those two. What would you advise?
Well, there's some warning signs to really pay attention to. You know, we're seeing a lot of things like withdrawing from family and friends for a long time. Some of these are actually hard to differentiate between, you know, your typical adolescent development versus not so typical. We know that, like I said before, I didn't go first to my parents to talk about things when I was in high school. Of course, I do now. But
we all do.
Right. Yeah. But just to understand that usually depression and or suicide, which the warning signs do very much coincide, that you are seeing withdrawal for long periods of time. And just like the story I brought up earlier, you know, withdrawing, seeking a lot of privacy. So, again, we know that teens do want to seek privacy.
I was going to say teens want to be private. Yeah.
Yes. But it's kind of like they're keeping a secret for a long period of time. So we're talking depression usually starts or lasts longer than 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And so it's not just, well, I'm going through something with my friends, I can't get myself out of this funk for a couple of days. It's more like you can't pick yourself back up for numerous days, for weeks, months, years kind of thing.
And what should you do at that point then? What do you recommend?
Ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
Ask lots of questions. Say, you know, what are some things that I can do to help? And that's the other thing. You don't always have to know what to say. And you can literally say that. Hey, I don't even know what to say right now. I'm just here to listen. I've noticed X, Y, and Z. As humans, we love to be observed, right? Hey, I noticed you weren't at lunch the other day. Where were you?
Yeah.
Kids are the same. We're all humans. We like to hear those things. Hey, I noticed that you weren't speaking out in class as much. Or I noticed that you're not hanging out with your friend as much anymore.
Right.
What, you know, what's up with that?
You know, one fallback position for a lot of parents would quickly be, well, would you be interested in going to see a counselor or a therapist that we could, you know, think about? And again, I think for some kids that can be very effective, Kathy. And for other kids, again, I'm thinking of boys, that can be a hard sell when you're 17 or 18 and trying to open yourself up and you're deepest secrets to a stranger that you've just met a few minutes before. What do you recommend along those lines?
You know, trying it. And making the fact that they are a stranger is actually helpful in a lot of ways. It's not somebody that they have to, you know,
worry about impressing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And knowing that there's someone there that is there specifically for them so that they can be able to reveal the things that are troubling them. It is hard, but I say, you know, give it a try. If you can get them there quite often, you know, they'll find the advantage to it. Another thing is that when you're finding someone to counsel or to have therapy with, is that it's kind of finding the fit. And yes, mm-hmm. you may not, you know, mesh with the first one, but shop around because there's someone there that has been trained to be able to help you through these things. And the kids need help through these things.
The other thing you hear a lot about is medication. How do you know when to pull that trigger, Kathy?
Well, again, a therapist is going to be a great source to be able to determine if that's the correct approach. At Tri-County, you know, we certainly promote, you know, working on the therapy, and then they'll be able to, determine whether or not medication is appropriate. We have assessment, you know, clinicians that will assess those type of things. So coming on in and taking, you know, those assessments, there are other agencies in the area. The assessments are free.
Right.
So coming on in and letting, you know, figuring out what resources are available, what you qualify for, being directed to those resources in the community that match up with your insurance or no insurance.
There's a lot of suspicion out there, even among young people, that these medications are vastly overprescribed. What do you say to that?
Well, that's definitely been a difficulty in some areas. So I can see that, you know, that is going around. But medications are very influential in helping when needed.
How can a parent tell if a more serious issue is in play? I'm thinking about bipolar syndrome or anything like that as well.
And again, the assessments, come on in and get those assessments so they can determine what, you know, you're actually dealing with. The symptoms of, you know, bipolar, anxiety, oppositional defiant disorder, there's just so many of them. So let's get an accurate diagnosis so that the treatment can then be effective.
We're talking this morning about preventing this epidemic of teen suicides that is a scourge not only in the metro but across the nation. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. That's our number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. We're joined by two guests from the Tri-County Mental Health Services that serves Clay, Platte, and Ray counties, Kelsey Prather and Kathy Blanche. What about folks who live south of the river in Jackson County? There's obviously resources here too, Kelsey. What would you point to?
Well, so I did, and this has to do with your question, also has to do with the therapy question. You know, on encourageopenhelp.com, there is a button that says, I need to find a local therapist or a counselor. You click on that button, you type in your zip code, and a list populates for you.
Mm-hmm.
We have Kathy as a therapist for north of the river, for kids 10 to 24. South of the river, you know, right now we have, basically north of the river, we have a grant called the Zero Suicide Initiative. And so we are able to have the prevention education side and then the clinical side, which is awesome. We're in mm-hmm. 14 different school districts, community coalitions. It's wonderful. South of the river, we do work with a couple of programs. Speak Up is one of them. I'm not sure if you've heard of them. But those types of programs are awesome because they help fund things that we actually have natural funding for, like Signs of Suicide Prevention Program, which we have implemented in a ton of our schools, which is the number one suicide prevention education program in the country.
It's actually part of the school curriculum now?
Well, it can be.
Mm-hmm.
There is a Missouri House bill that has passed that requires some kind of suicide.
I was just going to bring that up
mm-hmm.
here. Yeah.
Yep. So that's why we're having a lot of schools knocking on our doors saying, hey, can we get a hold of this? Because it is the best program. And we have amazing success stories on that. Kids, you know, are taught to acknowledge, care, tell. So acknowledge your friend is hurting. Let them know that you care. And tell a trusted adult. Get help involved. Mm. Don't tell your best friend. Don't keep it a secret. Get help involved.
That new Missouri law that Kelsey just mentioned requires all schools to have strategies written by July, I think, before the next school year begins, to prevent suicides and to root out online cyberbullies. In Kansas, there's also a new law, the Jason Flatt Act, that requires schools to train teachers and staff every year to spot early warning signs. How important is this legislation, Kathy? What difference will this make?
Oh, I'm thinking it's going to be huge. It's really important. You know, the statistics bear out that suicide is on the rise. And so it's important for schools. The primary place where children can be accessed has an understanding of what the risk factors are, has protective things in place, like this Signs of Suicide program that we're talking about.
You know, this stuff is so tricky. I teach up at UMKC, and it's always amazing to me. You know, you see kids working in a classroom, speaking up in a classroom, they seem just fine. Then you have a private conversation sometimes, and you realize the floor has dropped out of their lives in some fairly profound ways. And we are so good at disguising this stuff. I mean, you just don't know. So much of the time, sometimes you do, but so much of the time, you just don't know, Kelsey.
So that is actually defined as high-functioning depression. So I'm really glad that you brought that up.
There's a name for it.
Yes, because although we know the typical warning signs of depression, some people can hide that very well. And that's why when we actually implement signs of suicide, we try to equip, you know, the bus drivers, the cafeteria staff.
Even the bus drivers.
Oh, absolutely. Because the bus driver is going to see something completely different than the English teacher is, or even the counselor. And so to talk about, you know, these are the typical warning signs, but some kids, you know, we are, and Kathy can talk more on, that we are finding kids through this SOS assessment program that counselors even say, we had no idea, right? We hear that often. We had no idea. These kids are involved in 8 clubs and they are the class president, right? They are overcompensating. Usually the case is they're overcompensating for those feelings of anxiousness and depression. And so they are getting involved in every single thing that they can and trying not to think about that, right? And the thing about adolescents is they're very impulsive. That's the other thing. We're talking about their developing brains with the pressure, with the overcompensating feelings, with the impulsivity. And then you have things like suicide contagion.
So 1 minute they're watching cute dog videos or cat videos on YouTube, and the next minute they're thinking very seriously about suicide. That's what you're talking about here, right?
It could be.
Mm-hmm.
It's situational.
Yeah. You know, Kathy, I'm wondering, in just a few minutes we have left here, you know, maybe some context. We're talking about your organization, Tri-County Mental Health Services. We got suicide prevention lines. We've got new state laws that are in place. Clearly, society is ramping up efforts to get at this problem of teen suicide. My question is, are we doing enough? Are there still areas that, as an expert in this area, that you would point to that we need to be thinking about moving forward?
Absolutely. And it's wonderful, all this work that's going into it, and more does need to be done. I think, especially like for your audience, what parents can do is huge. And that is checking in with their kids, building that rapport, building the connection, understanding the warning signs and this isolation that they're doing. When they're losing interest in things that they've always cared about, and the access of the media that is, you know, shows that are on right now that are, you know, glamorizing suicide.
Yeah.
It's dangerous. And so parents need to be aware of what's out there, who their kids are seeing, where their kids are. Get more involved in your kid's life and develop that connection.
Kelsey, there's also this very prominent hit TV show, 13 Reasons Why, that has a lot of people talking. And some folks worry that it's encouraged some suicidal thoughts, suicidal actions. What do you say to that?
I would say that there are lots of other ways to get involved in suicide prevention and mental health awareness that are evidence-based programs. The problem with this show is that it really communicates it portrays feelings of guilt and revenge. With suicide prevention, the last thing that we want people to feel is guilt. And the last thing we want people to think that suicide is about revenge, that's not what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we could encourage, for me, I would not let my kids watch this.
That strongly about it.
There are two rape scenes, and there's a scene that you actually watch her kill herself, and you watch her parents find her. That is so traumatizing. And we live in a society where that's just accepted, and now it's a Netflix series. And we are saying that that's okay for our kids to be that traumatized over and over again. And it's simply not. So if we could actually encourage our kids not to watch that, but if they are interested in getting involved in suicide prevention, there are five other ways I can think of off the top of my head, such as getting youth mental health first aid certified, which is free. You can find that on couragehopeandhelp.com. Such as maybe you want to implement a mental health or suicide prevention campaign in your school. I can help fund that with this grant. There are lots of other ways that actually build protective factors and hope, and that do not, you know, provoke feelings of guilt.
I want to put out that suicide prevention lifeline phone number one more time here, 1-800-273-TALK, and also the crisis text line. You can text hello to 741-741. Okay. Well, thanks for a good conversation. I want to thank Kelsey Prather, again, with Tri-County Mental Health Services. Kathy Blanche, crisis clinician, also with Tri-County. Thanks for a good conversation and coming in today.
Thanks so much for having us,
appreciate Steve.
Yesterday in the show, we learned about a Kansas program that's helping kids raised in stressful environments become more resilient. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kratzky. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, we examine historical examples of hope overcoming divisiveness in America. Award-winning author John Meacham, one of this country's great historians, will join us for that conversation. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Steve Kratzky, and you are up to date.